So, about it.
Good. That's what you need, yeah.
Everybody does everything. I'm on the FAMJU advisory committee. I
Metcalf is one of the last deputy DA actually represents the state. That was a long time ago. But anyway, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
I'm Tom DeSantis, presiding judge out of Kings County, and done family law, done juvenile law, and we only have 7 judges, so I'm interested in being on this committee, see what's going on with our defense counsel.
Audrey Tansy, I am co-counsel to the Family Juvenile Law Advisory Committee on the juvenile side. I'll be staff.
I'm Don Will, also at the Judicial Council and staff to the subcommittee.
I'm Sherry Carter, I'm the executive officer for Los Angeles County, and I co-chair the Dependency Council working group of the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee with Judge Hope.
Second row. Should we, I should have started by saying this. We're on this is a public meeting, and so the proceedings are being recorded, correct?
Correct.
Everything's being recorded. And so what we all need to do, and nobody does it, but we need to try to remember when we make a comment to identify ourselves, which gets a little awkward. We know who you are. We can see the slide in front of you, but for the recording and for people on the telephone, if we could identify who's speaking. And by the way, I'm Mark Cope. And so then if we could get the introductions in the back row.
Sure, thank you. I'm Leslie Heimlob, the Executive Director of Children's Law Center of California. We represent all of the children in the dependency system in both Los Angeles and Sacramento counties. I've been with DOC for 25 years. We've been in LA the entire time, and in fact for 4 years. I'm also on the FAM Juve Advisory Committee and have been for 7 years, and I was recently appointed to the Future Commission to the FAM Juve Subcommittee.
Jill McInerney, Executive Director of Sacramento Social Welfare and Capital Center.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Chan, the Executive Director of Inhumane Children's Law here in LA County. My office represents all of the children in the
Sacramento. And good morning. Where is the man's body? The Vice President of Fort Wayne County.
I'm Candy Mays. I'm the Executive Director of the Dependency Legal Group of San Diego, and we represent all of the children and all of the parents in Juvenile Dependency Court in San Diego County. I've been practicing in the child office for 18 years. I founded the firm, and we started this particular contract in 2010.
My name is Andrew Kane. I'm supervising attorney with Legal Advocates for Children and Youth, Program of Law Foundation of Silicon Valley. We represent most of the children in juvenile dependency in Santa Clara County.
I'm Sarah Bayona. I'm a juvenile dependency attorney in Marin County. We represent parents with Dependency Legal Services. David Myers is the director of our organization.
And then on the phone, maybe what we should just do is find out who from which members of the committee are here on the phone. Is Kimberly Nystrom-Geist on the phone?
Yes, this is Judge Nystrom-Geist. I'm a judge in Fresno County, previously supervising family law judge, currently in a dependency delinquency assignment. I'm a member of the Family and Juvenile Advisory Committee and also of the Futures Commission.
Excellent. Thank you. And then Judge Smith, are you on the phone? Judge Smith is in Oakland and was concerned that she might be not be able to attend because of the whatever's going on over there with the basketball game. And Jake Chatters, are you on the phone?
Yes, I'm on the phone.
Okay.
I'm the executive officer for the Placer County Superior Court, and I'm currently a member of the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee.
I didn't leave off one thing in my introduction. I'm in Los Angeles County, where each of our judicial officers is averaging about 1,350 children.
Okay. Got that in there. Good for you. Thank you. Let's see. Okay, so let me just give a brief introduction. This is probably all information that everybody knows, but a brief introduction so that we kind of are all on the same page starting out. It's been about 4-5 years ago now when the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee undertook a process to look at how the courts are, how the various 58 courts are funded out of the trial court funding. And for the first time since the 90s, even though the funding has been provided by the state, the funding has been based on how funding was allocated in the 1990s. And so the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee, it was the Trial Court Budget Working Group then, but it became the Advisory Committee. They proposed the workload allocation funding methodology that was adopted by the Judicial Council. That's not necessarily directly relevant to this meeting today, except to the extent that as part of that process, there were many issues that came up that would have stopped the process. Like any time when you're looking at a big decision, you can easily get distracted into smaller, off into smaller areas that really don't affect the end result. And so what they did was they established a what they called a parking lot, a list of issues that needed to be addressed. They were related to but not directly impacted on by the workload allocation funding methodology. And one of those parking lot issues was one was had to do with complex civil courtrooms and how to fund those. And one of the big ones was how to fund the court-appointed dependency council. It doesn't directly come out of the trial court's budget, but it does impact the trial court's budget. And so we've been on that committee. We've been whittling away at that list of parking lot issues, and we've Stephen Chang is probably so sick of this whole process. But the issue we're working on right now is this one: the court-appointed dependency council. And so the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee put together a working group. Sherry Carter and I chaired that, and the working group proposed to the Judicial Council a new methodology for allocating funding. And the methodology that was proposed and accepted and adopted with a glide path into adoption, it was accepted by the Judicial Council, and it's now there. And it depends, the entire process depends on determining what the workload is for each of the, for dependency council in each of the 58 courts. Up until now, we've used the methodology. I think I'll leave to Don the explanation of how that's been formulated. But I think I've given you what I see as the reason we're here. When the Judicial Council visited this and adopted the process for changing how funding would be allocated, there were a number of concerns expressed, and I think some of them were by the folks here in the back row, about the validity of the numbers. So the Judicial Council wants to make sure that those are appropriate, and so the purpose for this meeting and this group is to look at those and see where adjustments need to be made, if adjustments need to be made, and to make recommendations to our respective committees, the BAMJUV and the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee, which will then make recommendations to the Judicial Council. Anything you want to add?
The only thing I want to add is something that Don reminded us, this is Geraldine Borak, reminded us of this morning, and that is that when the study was done for the workload and the various component parts of the data that was used in order to develop where we are today, it was a two-year study, and it was also a very expensive study, hiring staff and contract workers in order to gather the data, and I just want to remind y'all that we don't have 2 years, that the train is out of the station and it is going down the track. The Judicial Council has decided what will happen unless we are able to persuade them that something else needs to happen, and that they have given us until April. So we do not quite have the luxury, and we certainly don't have the budget to redo from scratch everything that got us to where we are today. That's the only thing I think that I want to throw in.
That's an important point. We're not starting from fresh. That study wasn't that long ago either. So we're not starting from fresh. We're just looking to see what adjustments need to be made to it. We should start with public comment. I understand there's one person, Mr. Chan, I believe you signed up, and you know, you're sitting in a good spot to just sit where you are if you'd like to, or else you can come up to that chair if you'd rather.
I'll just stand.
All right.
I'm Roger Chan, and thank you so much, first of all, for taking on this very important task. I just wanted to say that there were, first of all, a number of really important objectives that were laid out and identified in the original workload formula, but also that the workload for us as Tennessee attorneys has changed dramatically over the last 10 years. And both the additional rights and responsibilities, those additional rights and protections that sponsors have, and the responsibilities and expectations that their attorneys therefore have. And just also in terms of our understanding and appreciation for the way that parents and children and dependent support should be represented. And I think that is probably the number one objective of the original workload model, to ensure that every child and parent has scholars and representation in dependent support. As you also know, from the past several months, there are many of us who care very deeply about funding for the Dependency Council, and we care very deeply about the provision of quality and representation for parents and children. And we would very much like to be a part of this process. I appreciate that the state voter input plan includes a survey and a focus group to happen in July and August. But I think that there are many of us who could be of value and have a lot of information that will help inform the work this group. And I would encourage you to allow opportunities for more stakeholder input later on in the process to allow us to get feedback before final decisions are made. Thank you very much. And I did submit a written comment as well.
Right. And then we got those yesterday by email. Anybody not get a chance to see those? Because there was not only his comment, but there were a couple of other letters, some of them pretty detailed. So, good. Thank you. Don, was there anything else before we get started?
I just signed up for public comment.
Oh, I'm sorry. I only had his. So go ahead. Start with your name, please.
Thank you. Leslie Heimov again from Children's Law Center. I would echo everything that Mr. Chan said and would want to highlight that I think you do have a lot of resources beyond the people that are appointed to the committee, and many of us that have put a lot of thought into this situation. CLC is uniquely situated because we are a donor. We are, on one hand, a donor county, and on the other hand, a crisis county. So we are impacted by all the decisions differently in the two counties that we serve, and as a result are really trying very hard to look at this as a statewide issue and not just protect my own issue, which we hope that the committee will as well, because otherwise we're not really solving the problem. And I would also add with regard to the data and just comment, although the report was released in 2008, the time study was done in 2002. To me, that seems fairly old. And the practice has really changed quite a bit. And I think our experience, at least in the draft counties, is that what the Humane Association study reports should be the reality given. And so there's some disconnect there in terms of who we're able to hire and how much we're able to pay them and how much time they're actually spending to get the work done. There's a disconnect, I think, between what the data shows and what the Humane Association study expected and what we experienced in our actual contracts and in our experience. And then the last thing I would add is that there are certain concrete and objective things that have changed since we looked at how we count. And one great example of that would be that since AB12 passed, we now have a segment of clients, of child clients, where there is no corollary parent appointment because the parent is automatically relieved when the child turns 18. But the current data is based on a formula that says for every child we assume that there are it's 0.82 parents. But we know that for a significant portion of children, there are actually zero parents who have a lawyer. So that's just one example of other things that we need to look at that really might cause us to look at a different way to use the data and to tweak the formula, because there are certain objective factors that have changed beyond just the quality of work and those other sorts of things that I don't think have been factored into the formula at this point.
Okay, and then that reminded me of something else we had talked about, making sure that we pointed out. We have Pima County, I think you have four.
Correct.
And we have Los Angeles County with who knows how many checks.
I know exactly how many. Right.
She knows their phone numbers too.
Hopefully going up.
400 and
20 judges. Hopefully not.
Okay, so we have a broad spectrum here. But even though we have this group, it's important to do exactly as was said, that there can't be really any turf protecting. I'm not concerned about what happens to Riverside, and I'm happy to face my presiding judge and say, no, I voted against Riverside. We all need to do that. I guess I wouldn't be happy to do it, but I would do it. So we all need to be able to do that and consider the statewide issues and concerns and not just your own. The other point was that we're really talking about two different issues when we're talking about these things. One is we're talking about how much overall is needed to fund fund dependency counsel when we go talk to the legislature and when we talk to the governor's office. And frankly, dependency counsel in the state in the last couple of years have done a great job in the lobbying process trying to get that. We presented the number of $33 million that was needed, and right now that's looking like it's going to be about 11. I think I said 33,000. I meant 33 million. And right now it's looking like that'll be about 11 million. But that's based on 2002 numbers, and that number hasn't the formula for determining that 137 million needed overall hasn't changed, but circumstances have. So that's one of the things we're looking at. But our reality is that right now we're funded at about 74% of what we actually need statewide. And so all we're looking at for us is how do we divide up that 74% pie. And we can look at things like, AB 12 and other things like that, but they're equally as true in Tehama County as they are in Los Angeles County. And so those are two different, they're very closely related, but two different issues that we'll kind of need to keep in mind as we go through it. I think we should probably go to Don. Although we're on time, so Don, we're good.
The agenda was structured by the co-chair, and it's broken out so that we look at the key pieces of the methodology at sort of one at a time. So the first piece being attorney workload, and then the second piece after lunch being money, salaries, benefits, and overhead, and the third piece being the caseload, the number of folks who are serving. We tried to be proactive and Audrey and I did a webinar that was haunted by some technical difficulties, but I think we still got through it, and then we redid it as a recording and posted the webinar that's an overview of the caseload funding model, and in the hope that we could maybe come into the meeting and people would have sort of a head start on that. So I think maybe I would just ask, should we start with questions about the presentation and the funding model, or should we
Okay, so that's a great place to start. Everybody who has the materials, and the materials are available not only for members of the committee, but anybody else. Anybody who has them, you can see the PowerPoint presentation that was the basis for the webinar. And so are there questions or concerns that you want to raise about that? Well, I guess not. Yeah, we could make that 2 o'clock flight home. So then that takes us on to the discussion about the attorney workload in a dependency case and where the current model falls short. Is that what you're looking for?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
So, and perhaps the best place to start for that in our presentation is on page 9. Were you looking at page 9? Yeah. And maybe page 7. Maybe page 7 first, because the attorney time on the case is, this is how the final piece of the workload model, the one that winds up with an 88 case per attorney. when they are supported by a half-time social worker is how those numbers break down. And we're going to put it up on the screen.
So from the members of the committee, what do we need to tweak about the summary of the basic time standard for a child's attorney? That's what we're asking right now.
Yes.
Okay.
And also, what more do we need to know? Because there's quite a bit of detail in the 2007 legislative report. It has the chart of all the things that roll up to these attorney hours required per hearing. So what I guess more would people like to know, what comments would they like to make on the time scale?
All right, open it up. Are we satisfied that this accurately shows what time is needed by an attorney appointed to represent a child?
Well, one question, Ted Zeichner. With non-minor dependents, AB12, et cetera, and I was having a hard time understanding in terms of after the third post-permanency hearing, where does that play in?
After the third, so the workload model, it assumes that everything, if we could go to the next slide, which is the basis, it assumes that everything after that post-permanency hearing is all rolled into what they say the minutes are for that third year. So the workload model really counts an artificial, each case gets an artificial 3 years with the time allocated in these phases.
And that's in part because it was created before AB 12.
Yeah, it's in part because of that, and I think it's in part because the it was an easier statistical move to roll up the whole tail of the possible cases into what its average would be. It doesn't just, the average you see doesn't just count the third year of the cases in the study. It counts for life of the cases in the study, but it rolls it all in the third year.
Right.
This is Kim Nystrom-Geist. I have long cause dependency trials, so I primarily hear often 2-6 hearings, and I am having a hard time understanding how any attorney could ever do one in 1.92 hours. The minors counsel who are in my courtroom are usually there for, I would say, probably 8 hours in the courtroom for the trial, including argument, decision, and evidence. And I know they've spent substantial time preparing before that. So I just can't see, even in a short 2-6 hearing, how 1.92 hours would be accurate.
Sure. So this is very similar to actually questions that come up about the RAS model, and the way to look at it is that the workload model assigns this amount of time, 1.92, to every single case, so that there will be many cases that don't get a 2-6 hearing or an 18-month review or a post-permanency hearing. It's a weighted amount so that the cases that do have it, the average time would be much longer for the 2-6 hearing. But if you spread that time out over all the cases in the system, this is what the workload model calculates for an average case. That makes sense?
It does make sense. So for every one case that I have in my courtroom that takes 10 hours, that same attorney should have 5 that took 0 for a 2-6 hearing.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Thank you.
I have a question on that, Judge Patey. Have you compared the workload model with what's going on in all the counties to see if that's accurate?
No. We have... Definitely not. We've not taken the kind of detailed charts from the workload model and researched whether they're still accurate today.
So in other words, that was done at the time of the study, but it hasn't been verified.
That's what it takes now, yeah.
And I'll just put this out, in our county, our filings are down. The cases are more complicated, so I'd be curious to see how this workload model compares with the reality of what we have in our county, because I know from speaking with our representative here, we're, I believe, hovering around what the recommendation is of 188 cases per attorney. Right, Candy? Right.
Okay. Other comments from what we thought we would do is we'll take comments from the committee, and then we'll leave 5 minutes for public comments on that issue. Then we'll come back to the committee again. But they undoubtedly have issues to raise that we hadn't raised yet. Let me go to Tom and then back to you, Carolyn, if that's all right.
No problem.
This is Tom DeSouse. My thoughts on coming onto this committee was that the workload model was 2002 data, you know, 1.92 hours, whatever. But I thought one of the issues we were going to look at was how it compares to now and the changes that have impacted all the counties. I think Judge Patty indicated you're down but more complex. I think ours are up and continuing to increase with respect to the load on our juvenile judge as far as 2-6 hearings and the like.
How would you propose that we do that without starting over?
And I'm not certain that we start all the way over. That's why I look to staff to say, you know, do we do a quick survey where the PJs or the send in the info that they have right now? And we can, you know, take a quick look at it and say, because I think Judge out of Fresno County is,
sure, you have five cases that are zero.
One that's 10 hours, go forward extrapolated. Is that what your filings are in the county?
Okay.
I was just going to bring up a couple of things. The workload model, does it factor in the obligations that it doesn't, does it, in terms of collaborating with the court and also continuing education and things like that, or is that the afternoon part of it?
No, it's a good question. I'm thinking I have to go back and check if it does have time for meetings and for that sort of work. I'm not sure what it is. It would be very small. The workload model does factor in that an attorney out of a, you know, 1,700 hours is often used to see kind of of work hours that someone has, that out of that there's, I think, about 1,100 hours spent doing casework. So it would factor in somewhat that way, but I don't think it's explicit. We could certainly.
Let's say that again. So of the 1,700 hours you used, you only counted 1,100 hours as in court work. Is that what you said?
I believe so. I have to
leaving
go back.
Leaving 600 hours for the other miscellaneous things like case write-up and
running a business.
Running a business,
travel.
Dealing with the meeting and things like that. Okay.
So Judge Cooper, Judge Borak, this is Jake Chatters. It's my turn.
Okay, Carolyn's going to finish, and then we'll go to David Yamasaki, then Jake. I mean Judge Kay.
That's all right.
Sorry about that.
We've known each other a long time. There was also a question, I think some of the folks that are here in the audience raised about family maintenance cases. Are those factored in this as well or not? Or
the caseload number that we use from the county includes court or family maintenance cases that are court supervised. So the case, yeah, so it's included. It's not that type of work, say, it's not. Wasn't part of the workload model, but those cases get counted as well as the child welfare department report them.
But you didn't count them like as the permanency 6 month review equivalent or the post permanency equivalent, depending on how
it's
long.
It's not adjusted for that type. I mean, if 10% of cases are court supervised family maintenance, they're not adjusted in any way. They get the same weight.
And then lastly, the specialty courts, I think that was alluded to as well. Like in our county, we have a lot of specialty courts. I think some of the others do, drug court, although we don't have legal representation there, but some of the other types of court hearings, are those factored into this? No.
No.
Okay.
I can tell you why it's not my turn, but I'll tell you why I think they shouldn't be factored in when it is my turn to take.
So thank you, Judge David Yamasaki. One of the issues that had come up in our review of the RAS study, which is the resource allocation study that was what was fed by the timeline evaluation of the different cases, was there was an average that was gleaned from courts that perhaps were expeditious in processing cases and perhaps courts that spent a little more time. That was a snapshot in time. Part of the expeditious processing of a case is attributed to just survival. There just wasn't enough time to dedicate a court's time in processing a case. And where there may have been additional resources at a court where you have maybe more judges dedicated to a particular case type, there was a little more time that was available to spend. Looking at the information, it's difficult for me to determine whether this number is ideal.
Mm-hmm.
What is the appropriate amount of time that is needed, or is it we just don't have enough people, we can only commit so much time to a case, and that's what was factored into the amount of hours that was attributed to it. So that's one of the details that I was hoping that we might be able to re-examine, if time permits, to try to get to a point where we can land on, you know, maybe on the longer side of time, and that, of course, would affect the necessary resources that would be, you know, required to process the cases. I don't know if that's something that we would be able to achieve within that April deadline.
If I could just respond briefly, this is Gerald Borak. From the way I read the information regarding the last time this was put together, there was a survey taken where attorneys actually reported how much time they spent, and then it was looked at, and there were enormous caseloads. And it was decided that if that's all you used, that you would never get to a point where you had what was ideal. So then it was decided what would be ideal, and then I think we somehow arrived at something in between the ideal and what was really happening to try to get to the mark of what was minimally appropriate for adequately representing clients. Am I correct about that?
That's absolutely right. You were on both groups, right?
I was, and it was not just taking an average of the high and the low. It was not. There was more balanced thought in terms of what would be required to do the various stages of the case.
Jay Chatters.
Thanks, Judge. Okay, this is Jake Chatters, obviously. So I had a couple of just clarifying points, I think, so that we're all on the same page. So on page 10 of the PDF, which looks like a self-labeled page 10 of the materials, it's in the PowerPoint, probably two slides down from where you're at, I'm guessing, because you were on the pie chart.
Yeah.
It just talks about the number of hours. So for the attorneys, it's listing their 1,476 hours, right? So
that was my mistake 10 minutes ago. I said 1,000, and I should have said 1,476.
Right. But that,
So just make sure we're on the same number there. So that means there are about 300 hours between the 1,476 and the more common 1,778, 1,790 that's used for an FTE. So that 300 hours would presumably be training or administrative time or other time that is not specifically spent on casework. Just so we're clear there. And then there's also the overhead percentage, which comes in later at 30% on top of everything, which I don't recall when the first group met. I was on that group as well several years ago. I don't remember whether that specifically included meetings with the court, although I think you could argue that a 30% amount on top, which includes supervision, would also include those sort of system meetings. But I had one question for you, Don, if you could, just to make sure I understand, going back up two slides back to that pie chart. The way that the math was done is that you are using the number of cases as collected by child welfare, and you're saying that based when we did the study initially, that snapshot of that year, or the analysis is that if we got 500 cases, which we don't, but let's say we got 500 cases in Placer County, we're using that number as a new filings number, or the number of kids, I guess it's not new filings, we're talking the kids that are in foster care now. The assumption is 47% of them are in year one, 37% are in year two, and 16% are in year three of those that are currently in care.
Year three and onward, yes.
Okay.
That's correct. Is that it, Jake?
That's it for now, sure.
Okay.
A couple of things. Thing is that in terms of how things have changed, you can't just look at the judicial officers and what is changing in your county, but you have to be looking at the lawyers and the firms and what they're saying has changed. And as I was sitting here, we were talking about the family maintenance cases, even those are more complex because we're experiencing a much higher percentage of our cases having a domestic violence component, which means you end up now a lot more than 10 years ago with temporary restraining orders, and contested custody orders at the end and contests in the middle where the non-custodial parent is now having more issues. So as I'm starting to think about how have things changed in the last 10 years, domestic violence is a major component, and that impacts the 364 and 361.2 review.
And the challenge is going to be not only thinking about how it's changed, but how can we quantify that into this?
Right.
And I'm not sure how to do that absent another $600,000 to spend on it. Let's spend 5 minutes listening. No, first Sherry Carter, and then we'll listen to the public comments.
Well, it's been interesting for me to listen to the judges because you're in the courtroom and understand it. But I'm kind of going back to what you had said, Judge Culp, that we really have. Sounds like there's two related but separate issues. One is, I'm assuming that these changes are impacting all the counties the same. And so, and there might be little nuances, but as an average, or they're probably hitting most counties the same. As we look at that component, that would raise the branch need. What we're trying to do today, since the Judicial Council has approved the funding methodology, which is we're going to use a workload standard, and we're going to allocate new money this way, and we're going to try to get all of the standards aligned over a four-year period. I wonder if we could, if it would be a good idea to identify those things that might be good to look at over time when there is more time. But for the things related to April, are there specific things that are less branch-related and more related to impacting moving to the second year of a four-year phase of reallocating resources to bring everyone to the same attorney standard in 16-17. Because some of the things like measuring these time frames, I think we should look at because I think we have a responsibility to the legislature and the governor to say, you know what, we need a lot more than $33 million, we need $45 million or whatever it is, and maybe those should be listed for more time, but the ones that we need to do by April, which are there elements or components of the workload model that we need to review for our what's due in April that we need to look at, recognizing we need to go back and do this work. So that was kind of a suggestion.
Mark, just one thing to add before we take the public comment. This is Todd Bakke from Tehama County. I'm looking at the statewide filings report for 2000 through 2001, the year before the 2002 data was provided. For our county, for example, 127 filings, and then last year, the new report will come out in about 60 days, it's 130, so it really hasn't changed. But if you look at, for example, Los Angeles, in 2000 and 2001, this is initial filings from the GPSIS data that is input. You have 11,424 filings in 2000 through 2001, and now 21,000 filings. So it's doubled. And I know we only have so much time with April looming, but how much sense does it make to use that data that?
Child welfare data. I did run some models when we co-chaired the funding piece. I was kind of curious myself and have no personal life, and so on a weekend I ran some models. It was interesting to see how the funding piece changed when you used a component of the GPSIS along with child welfare. We need to have, I thought, you're the expert, but I thought we needed a component that represented pending, and that seemed to be the child welfare numbers. But recognizing most of the work is in the new filings, I ran models that had 25% credit with GPSIS and 75% with the child welfare, and then 30%, you know, and so on. It was a really interesting model, and I think something that staff could easily do. So if that's one of those elements that impacts year two of a four-year phase-in that we think we need to look at, it might be something that the group wants to ask staff to do, because if I could run the modeling on a weekend, I'll bet you have people a lot smarter than me that could do it.
Yeah. If you're going to use a WAFM-type model, you have to have fairly current data. That's all there is to it. But, I mean, how are you going to get that in this time frame?
The problem with current data is that it doesn't stay current very long.
Sure.
And the child welfare system has so many different component parts that drive our workload, primarily how the Department of Child Welfare in each of our counties believes it needs to operate, and its policies, and whether they front load with informal supervision, and how successful that is, and how that relates to how many petitions, and if they don't believe in informal supervision, then they file on every black and blue mark, or have they lost three kids, you know, to death, you know, and they get all excited about that. And that goes for one or two or 3 years, and then it drops off again. In Sacramento County, for example, our caseloads were way up until about 2010, through that 3 years before 2010. In 2010, they went almost vertically down. How do you explain something like that?
We've had that too with a certain CPS director that comes and then goes, and it goes up and down, and we see it even in a small county. But again, 2002, like Leslie said, is a long time ago.
Yeah, we also ought to make clear, though, that the data that is used on the funding side of this is using current data.
Sure.
I don't have any disagreement with you, but we don't need to worry about the numbers doubling. What we need to worry about was what one meant then versus what one means now. Does that make sense at all?
That's a great way to put it.
Okay, let's give 5 minutes to folks in the back. And I don't know how to divide this up among you, because if one of you speaks for 4 minutes, the rest of you are up a creek. So
we're trying to pass each other notes and coordinating a little bit, but and texting and whatnot. So I'll start. I won't take 4 minutes.
We'll see if you do after you're done.
We will.
First, I would say I think these have been great and fast, great questions and great discussion. I've been able to check off things I was going to say because one of you said them, so thank you. But in terms of this piece, responding to Sherry's comment in particular about separating out, we need more money overall from what are we going to do in the next year or two to deal with the parity issues between the counties. I think the point about files is very important, and just because what I'm not understanding, and this is more of a question than an answer, is if we know that in that things like the filings are going up in one county and down in another, why isn't the formula seeming to match that? Why are those counties not getting more money in one year and being adjusted accordingly based, even if it's based on the CWS-CMS data, which I may or may not have issues with, but whatever data we're using is not reflecting the amount of money that's going into contracts. So I don't know how that gets addressed in this, but it seems like it should. And as an example, Sacramento County, is, according to the chart, is funded at almost 120%, but we spend all of the money in our contract the way that we're supposed to. It's a draft county, so it's very clear as to how we're supposed to allocate, and our lawyers have over 200 cases each. So how could we be at 120% when each attorney is representing 200 children? And so there's some disconnect that I do think is very relevant for how the data, even the data that we have, is being crunched to determine the allocation for each county and within each county each contract. Because in most counties, there's at least two contracts, I believe, parents and kids. The fewer is one big one, but most of us are separated. So that's one of the things that I think we're struggling with. Back on the, we were talking earlier about what goes into a case and the time that's allocated. In addition to all of the more squishy things we talked about, is there's more domestic violence, but that's not quantified necessarily. There are certain things that are statutorily mandated now that were not statutorily mandated in 2002. And so there may be a way to use some of the statutory changes and obligations to impact without doing a whole new time study. To look at that piece of it, which I know goes to the other question.
Hi, Jill McInerney here in San Francisco. And I just wanted to make sure that everybody was clear that there is actually a lot of data that you all have at your disposal. I know San Francisco is not a draft county, but we all independently enter our billing into the Bar Association of San Francisco, and we keep very, very strict. We use time codes and phase codes, and so we have a lot of data. I know that draft counties have input their data for 3 months every year. So if you're looking for snapshots that are more updated from 2002, and I would encourage you to do that, there's plenty of data to get at least a glance at how things change. And I would really encourage you to delve into the data that already exists rather than worrying about trying to recreate the wheel.
Hi, I'm Kenny from San Diego. And one of the things that I just wanted to encourage you to think about as you talk about what the minimum amount is required to get adequate representation. I understand the accounting piece that we have this many attorneys, we think it takes this many hours, and that equals this many. But the reality is people go out on FMLA, people go out on leave, and people need vacations once in a while. And so the amount of staffing that's required for specialty courts to cover those leaves so that everything doesn't come to a halt, to make sure that someone can attend a meeting with the court or other things. That all takes people. And I understand that we can't necessarily have the ideal amount of people that we would all like to have to make everything as efficient as possible, but I want to make sure that those business realities don't get lost when we're just looking at spreadsheets and numbers. And so I would just encourage you to keep those staffing requirements and needs in mind, because it does impact what we can do as providers if we are taken down to the bare minimum level of staffing and we have two people calling for instead of just one.
Yeah,
Andrew Kim, legal advocates for children and youth in San Jose. On the point that I think Leslie was making about the evolution of statutory mandates, encompassing that also is the evolution of core practices and what that means for our workload. And specifically, I do think it's going to be good that this committee focuses on what the specialty court dynamic means for all of this. I think it was Judge Cope earlier who alluded to some thoughts as to how that should play into this. From the perspective of Minors Council, I know the Parents Council in our county echoes this thought. We do devote a lot of time in our county to specialty courts. It takes up time that we could be devoting in other aspects, and so I don't think it can be ignored. It wasn't accounted for in 2002, largely because the phenomenon had not evolved the way that it has now. And so I would encourage a pretty frank discussion about the role of that playing and what our overall workload is as we move forward.
Okay, anybody else from the public, briefly?
Judge Hernandez from Orange County. Overall, I have a concern just of losing sight of doing no harm with the issue of trying to make parity across the state counties, and I completely understand that. But what I see there, and I know there's only a 74% piece of the pie, but I think we need to have the current snapshot because the funding methodology that's utilized now, certainly, at least from my county's perspective, it's not reflective of where we're at, the complexity of the cases that the lawyers are doing now. Our numbers have two dropped, as Judge Cayetti explained, but I will also tell you just as of yesterday, I just had a writ dropped for extraordinary funds for a 6,000-page trial and dispo hearing. So the complexity of what's going on is not reflected in what is here. And for us to say we are going to continue with quality representation for our children, what we have in front of us right now is not going to effectuate that. So I think the input of all of these folks is necessary, and we can't just say, I know the train has left the track. I got that. It's out of the house. But, you know what, we need to get on it and do something about it and have the input and change this because as it is not accurate.
David.
Thank you. David Yamasaki. I wanted to just, I'm recalling back a discussion that took place at the Budget Advisory Committee. Along with Judge Cope and Sherry, were on the subcommittee that examined this issue and supported the change in the formula to address the inequity in funding that exists with the different courts who are receiving monies in this area. But the points that were made at the Budget Advisory Committee really resonated with me, and that is even jurisdictions that may be in excess of 100% of the formula, we're still expressing the impact, the really adverse impact of any reductions in this particular area. And that's one of the reasons why I was a dissenter at that time that vote was taken, because I wanted to see if we could take a look at the variables that are used to support the funding model. Is it appropriate to see or to gather information as it relates to what has happened to the jurisdictions where the funding has excelled beyond the, let's say, the 100% formula versus those jurisdictions where they've fallen far below that? I mean, what's happening? Is there a positive that's taken place, or is it just the same outcome regardless of the jurisdiction? So there's been no positives gained. So I'm curious to find out if there's any information that might be able to reflect what's happening. Is it an improved outcome? I don't know what it is. I've never really taken a look at the data, and if that's information that could be captured, I think it would be helpful. And that may be a basis to, you know, advocate for a lot more, or substantiate what we went in with to the legislature, you know, where they supported 30-some-odd million dollars and the outcome was only, was 11, which was obviously extremely appreciated, but clearly we were hoping that we could receive more.
So, as I understand what you're saying, what you want to
like to see us do is to gather some information about, for example, best practices type of thing, and the concomitant, perhaps, savings in terms of...
Either savings or the meeting the objectives of why the dependency council program was really established to accomplish. Is that information that could shed light on the subject?
Even in the original budget change proposal for the $33 million, we did include data about the relationship between how a county was funded, how a court was funded, and things like time of reunification and reentry rate. And it shows, depending how you look at it, it shows correlation. And those were the things that the original when the draft was started. The committee came up with a set of those outcomes, and so those are the ones we use. So that is definitely available, and I think that it's not really on the committee's agenda, but we are always staff interested in better ideas on measuring performance. So any discussion on that helps us.
And that comment is really important about what's been on the committee's agenda, because what you're talking about is a long-term reanalysis of what appropriate funding is. What I'm talking about is how you divide up the $114 million that we expect to get next year. And if I don't...
103, because the 11 the council's already approved how new money will be allocated.
Good, yeah, good point. I shouldn't have used the number. I always get in trouble when I use the number, but how we divide up what we get next year. And I lost my train of thought, but that's I don't remember. I'm glad I don't have the list of courts in front of me and what they get. But when one court gets 100, there are actually outliers that I won't use because they completely destroy the curve. But one court gets 147% of what our current model says the need is, and another court gets 47%. I hope the court that gets 140% has better results, because that's what's best for the kids. But what do you tell a family in the court with 47%? I think we've been accused of racing toward mediocrity. We're just trying to find equity. Now I wanted to make a comment about the specialty courts. Specialty courts, I mean, study after study, you know better than I do, study after study shows there can be benefits and advantages to doing that. But from an administrative, a fiscal perspective, this group really only has the authority to, or the charge, to look at how we allocate the funding. How we decide what the workload is based upon which the funding will be allocated by somebody else. With the Troncor Budget Advisory Committee and also with this committee, I would argue we need to look at is how does the court get the funding, and then what the court does with that funding is up to them. So they need to decide, we'd like to have a specialty court, but we can't afford it with the funding we have, versus we want to have a specialty court and you pay for it. Does that make sense? No, not so much.
No, you're looking at me.
The thing
swirling in my mind is, I get it, you're talking money, and this is Judge Coyote, but in the back of my mind is, it's shown to have better outcomes for these kids and these families.
Then that would be true in the court that does have it and in the court that doesn't have it, that they're not meeting the needs of their kids in that court because they can't afford it or whatever reason. But that's a decision. There's a lot of decisions that we make on a fiscal basis. We could do better if we had more money. We don't have the money, so we can't do that. And there's also a lot of decisions that we have to weigh.
it would be good to have a specialty court. On the other hand, it would be good if our attorneys had the money to do something else. And actually, wouldn't a specialty court reduce the money needed for attorneys?
It might, because you might have more success quicker and close cases quicker, so it might be a wash.
And also, I think you said that attorneys don't appear in your drug court.
In our drug court, and in some of our other, what you might call, loosely specialty courts, they do.
Okay. Okay, good, fair enough. My point is just that we shouldn't fund based on the decisions the court makes. We give the funding we can, and then the court decides what to do with this funding. That's been a core principle of WAFM, too. A lot of people have argued various times during this process, well, we ought to fund best practices. Well, we would like to, but we can't. We fund with what we have, and then you decide how to spend it. I'm confusing funding and workload analysis, and I apologize for that, but I wanted to address that.
Oh, okay. I was just going to say, I think David's idea has a lot of merit, but you covered the points I was going to make, which is that I think it's more of a more long-term study, and I think what we'll find is the courts that are significantly under the standard don't have the ability to have the specialty courts or the collaborative courts because they're so busy when they're carrying so many kids, they just can't do it. And so, it doesn't mean we shouldn't do it, because if that's the model that we believe is right for the children of California, I think we should find out what those measurements are and use them to help build a bigger branch need, because we all, I mean, I think every child in California should have those outcomes, right?
Judge Zeigler, and then back to Judge Kaizi.
So this is probably opening the wrong can of worms, but it's actually, you just mentioned that there, Don, that there have been some outcome studies done to some extent. Has there been comparison between draft counties and non-draft counties in terms of outcomes?
Yes, in fact, that was presented to the Judicial Council in 2010, 2011, something like that, that draft counties were faring better on some of those outcomes. I'm not sure that's the case. We haven't looked at it for a while, but it was done.
I don't have the chart in front of me, but also draft counties out of the 20, I think it was 17, were above the 100%
yes,
line. Out of the 38, I think there were four that were above the 100% line. So you're comparing results with funding, which is exactly what David said.
Right.
So that's a fair point.
Or the emphasis on practices that were done.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And the ability to understand the outcome made it such that the caseload was so reduced that it now looks like they're overfunded.
Fair point.
I have several. I wanted to follow up on some of the comments that folks made, but also going back to the specialty court issue. And one way of what I think I'm hearing too is for the counties that have a practice of trying to, that has shown that the results are in a positive direction for the children and families, basically what I think I'm hearing is you have to make a choice then. You're going to get penalized if you have those courts because it's not going to be factored into the current. It's not factored into the current model. Is what I think I'm hearing. Maybe not. But the other part, I had a couple of questions. A real basic question: what are you defining as a case? Is it by family? Is it by child? Is it who's it by?
Child.
Child. Okay.
So every child in dependency is a unique case.
And then Leslie made a comment about, and I was curious what the response would be when she was talking about, I think is it Alameda? Which one was the one where you're at 120%?
Sacramento.
Sacramento, that's right. So her comment was they're factored in as being 120%, but 200 cases per attorney. And it doesn't seem to reflect, there's a disconnect. What's the response, just so I understand it, what's the response to that?
I think the response is that's why we're having this meeting.
Yeah.
Are not ideal, we know model is not prescriptive. It's not what how a firm has to run its business. It's just how we calculate an estimate of what it's going to cost. And we know it's off. So I would say it's not surprising what Leslie says, and that the caseload model as it is now, as the salaries are now, doesn't reflect reality.
Is it too early for me to perhaps suggest that we do have staff look at modeling and see if we do include a component of new filings along with child welfare? Because I think child welfare numbers are important because of the pending component. But I would think that might answer some of it. I would just think that it would be helpful for us to look at some modeling that would include the justice numbers as a weight. I don't care if it's 25. I ran it at 25, 50, and 75, I think. And I'm not saying those are the right percentages, but it might be good for us to look at that modeling or better modeling.
Can you explain? I'm not understanding what you're saying.
So right now.
Real English.
Okay. So, non-English terms, I'll do my best. Right now, we get credit for every child that the child welfare reports. So, we use child welfare numbers, and it's per child. What I did is I created a model that used that number for 75% of the total, and for 25% of the total, I used the new filing numbers from GIPS. Now, you could use
case filings,
new filings, because my thought was, in the beginning, there's more work when the case is originally filed, and then you have maintenance and other issues for the pending. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I was just doing this really more for my curiosity. On the 25%, I only used 1 year of filing. You could average it over 3 years to smooth. You could use 50% to smooth it over 3 or 5 years. I mean, there's a whole variety of modeling that we could look at. But it did change. So when you change, because the funding methodology is based on workload, I wanted to see if I looked at the numbers differently in the workload, how would it adjust the funding, and it does. So whether if, and you know, it'd be interesting for me to pull out my notes and talk to Leslie about do any of these models fit Sacramento. I don't know, because I never talked to her, did I, at all, when we were doing this. So I would suggest that maybe we ask staff to look at some different modeling that might incorporate the new filings as a component. Maybe it's 10%. Maybe it's, you know, I don't know. But it's an easy, my thought is it's an easy thing to do that would give the committee more data than what we have if we feel that there's a question on whether or not the child welfare numbers are the right ones to use. In my presentation to the council, for those of you who are there, I never claimed the numbers were wrong, and I think that was a miscommunication that somehow spread like wildfire. The numbers aren't wrong. The numbers from the child welfare system were correct. I was wondering if there were better numbers to use, and it might be that we want to look at that.
So in plain English, are you saying court case
filing
front end determine which courts are court case front-end loaded?
No, what I'm saying is to develop a workload model that would rely on a component of new case filings as well as child welfare data to represent the pending cases as the new model, rather than just child welfare numbers.
Right. A model that takes into consideration
new filings.
Who's the front-end, the front-end
yes.
of the court.
Yes.
How do we factor in one attorney representing three siblings in a case with the number of case filings when, you know, the kind of quote-unquote ordinary, I haven't seen one yet, an ordinary case, but I know that they exist, that it's not three times the workload because you have three kids. How is that factored in before?
There's a discussion of that in the one of the methodology reports. And I'm smiling because I'm thinking. I'm sorry. I'm trying to visualize it in my head. Anyway, I believe that the conclusion the committee reached was they looked at different ways of weighting that, and they talked. They went out to, I believe, the first draft providers and talked about how much extra work was involved, and I think they decided that that it was a wash, and they would just count direct cases that the sibling issue didn't play in that much into workload.
Okay.
I'll pull that wherever that discussion is and put it into our materials.
So they decided it was statistically insignificant. There just weren't enough of them to change the
Well, it didn't. There were a lot of sibling cases, but that piece, trying to weight it by whether the case had siblings or how many siblings, okay, would not have made a really substantial difference to the ultimate outcome of the model. But, you know, I think it's like everything in that study, is anything can bear looking at again, but I'll pull the discussion for you.
So I would like to hear a little bit more discussion about the topic that that Sherry just brought up, and that is where do we think or how do we think the data, where should the data come from, and what data should we be looking at, and how should we be looking at it?
We had a similar discussion yesterday on the 1058 money in using DCSS's statistics out of Sacramento versus new filings, because there's going to be a difference between the two, but even though they're similar and they're different, there's value to using both. And I won't belabor the point with that, but nonetheless, I think what Sherry's talking about makes sense to have just another column in the spreadsheet to show, because there are a lot of times where DCSS is doing, you know, informal resolution with the families in many counties, and the attorneys do get involved, but there isn't necessarily a filing. Or there's a filing and things are held in abeyance while they're doing whatever they're doing. So you have to account for that somehow, and that's just another sort of layer to the onion that I think should be in there, and it's a pretty easy thing to do.
So we're to the stage, I think, unless somebody disagrees, and that's fine if you do, but we're at the stage where we can start figuring out the tasks to give Don for him and his staff to follow up on so that we can talk about it again in another meeting as soon as 3 or 4 weeks from now. He says he doesn't need long to do this. First, anything else, though, that we ought to do before we start figuring out those tasks? What?
Don't need long to figure out how to do that. Maybe the summer to do it, but I can tell you how we can do it.
Apparently I misspoke on that. I'll let him clarify because I still don't understand. Okay. So, is there anything else, though, other thoughts before we go to that, try to figure out what tasks to assign him? Okay, so do you have a clear enough picture of what Sherry's asking for?
I do, and it's that I'm like Sherry. That's the kind of thing I do for fun at night, is look at GIFs versus child welfare versus poverty versus kids in the U.S. So yeah.
I think that'll be really helpful to see what difference would it make if we use those numbers or hybrid those numbers. So, yeah, that's great.
I just had one suggestion for you, which is that we could bring the principal investigator to a conference call of the Berkeley data system if people wanted to ask questions about the validity of that data, where it came from, how it was put together. We could put that person on the phone.
Is there interest in that? Okay, I'm seeing nodding instead of shaking, so let's do that.
Well, she was tired.
Okay. And the reason I'm whispering is because when I was working on this, I actually exchanged several emails with the head of the Berkeley group, and her response to me was this. I have no idea. I just get it from the child welfare and put it in a spreadsheet. So, you know,
No, I mean,
they rely on the child welfare departments, which, and the counties are required to submit these because that's where they get grant funding and all sorts of federal funding. So the county has to ensure that the numbers are submitted for them running their department, but I don't know if the Berkeley people will be able to tell us a whole lot.
Well, I think if we brought the Berkeley people and then the person at social services who
that would be
oversees the data stream and to Berkeley between us,
perfect. That's,
so that's what we're.
Okay, there's that. What other tasks can we ask them to follow up on? Remember, the issue we're talking about is the how to weight the attorney workload on a dependency case. So what can we look into? What data can we collect to help us get more accurate numbers on that? Jake, we know you're there. And Judge Nystrom, guys, we know you're there, so speak up.
Should we be looking at the age issue, the 18 to 21-year-olds? Well, I guess that's going to be in the same county as county in terms of percentages. We can, you can assume that.
The how that, I believe, might affect the picture that, that we've been given is the ratio of children's attorneys to parents' attorneys. So I think that that would probably have to be tweaked, but how would we find out what percentage of the child cases are now in the AB12 area?
Well, that piece is reported at, through Department of Social Services. The piece about parents and sort of confirming or changing that number, we would do through a survey.
So we have numbers somewhere. How many people are 18, 19,
yes.
20?
Yes, we do know that.
And we know that those folks who are 18, 19, 20 do not have a parent component. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So,
well, do we know that?
I don't know.
The code says you can need parent counsel. I'm not too sure it's required, because we were on children's counsel, so that was one of my questions on Matt. We got parents' counsel, is to what extent we have any numbers on phantom parents. You know, some, to what extent do some counties relieve parents' counsel after the parent's been whereabouts unknown for 6 months, and what, to what extent do other counties not relieve them, and you have them still keeping those numbers on their books that they're getting paid for. So, I think both of these relate to parents' counsel.
That's a good point.
Because there could be places that are not relieving parents because AB 12 allows you to but doesn't require you to.
Well, and how do we know when parents' counsel relieved? For example, I did my own little survey about who appoints counsel for parents just for purposes of determining the paternity issue so that they have an attorney. And then when you determine that it's not a parent, this person is not a parent, counsel is relieved. Where does that ever show up in numbers?
Some keep for alleged, whereas some only keep once they're found to be biological or presumed.
Right.
So how do we phrase that into a task for him?
Well, the first half of it is the 18 to 21.
That's the easier half, and probably if what we're doing is just doing a drive-by for purposes of completing this by January or so, that would be good enough for now. Just while I have that thought in my mind, I really do believe that this is a very important area for our families and our children, and our ability to do what a court is supposed to do for these families and children. And it was said earlier about best practices and cost savings and economies, and I think that that is definitely the task of the Judicial Council to set those kinds of policies and head
the judicial, the statewide judicial branch in that direction. And I would like, at the end of all of this, to perhaps have some consensus on advising the Judicial Council about what the picture ought to look like.
Yeah. Future tasks, and that we've already been agreeing.
And I would like to be able to base it on what we were talking about in terms of best practices and the relationship between that and getting children reunified and permanent somewhere.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Have you discussed, I apologize, I was late, have you discussed the time, possibly extra time it takes if there's an interpreter involved in the case for either the parent's attorney or the child's attorney? I would think that would indeed require additional time.
And if we did that, we'd also then have to get numbers on counties' different variations regarding a percentage of interpreter cases between them.
Which, quite honestly, would be almost impossible because I don't think many courts use the CIDIC reporting software that.
So the task on that is find out what data might be available. Is that fair enough?
On interpreters.
Where would the impact be, just in the courtroom or also more time out of the courtroom?
Overhead costs, perhaps, when attorneys need to speak with their clients and need to have some way to be able to do that two different ways.
Okay. Or in court staff, then, when you're talking about children's counsel, where they might rely on that 0.5 person to be doing that instead of the attorney.
So, Judge, this is Jake Chatters. I just had a question I might not have heard specifically. So is one of the to-dos for Don or others at the judicial counsel staff to collect by county or court, I guess it would be by county, the number of non-minor dependents in the 18 to 21 range and bring that back to the next meeting? Is that an actual to-do?
Yes.
Okay.
I have another question about do all counties count their cases and do their data in a similar fashion, so that we're comparing apples with apples and oranges with oranges?
See, I have that question in terms of if each case we're looking at is a child. My county, where the court case is done as the mother, when a 300 petition is filed on a new baby, is our county reporting that new baby separately, and is it tracked? Because when we get to the front end, back end, and that 25% and all that, is that all being tracked?
So I'm going to answer a little bit. Even though we track by mother male, we still report gypsies by child. So we break that out. So we're reporting it consistently on gypsies. For the child welfare in the county, I don't know.
I think it has consistency problems. And I think that they probably especially have problems reporting if the case is court supervised or voluntary. And then.
You mean social welfare?
Social welfare.
That's Berkeley data, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Then on the positive side, they put a fair amount of money into training and QA. But yeah, I think there's real problems.
And I'm certain that some counties are like right up to date in getting their numbers correct when cases close, and other counties
have some lag time in doing that, so there would be no data is perfect, right?
And that almost raises a completely different issue, which is case closing and how that gets back to a court question of when does the case close. It won't leave the county caseload until the case is closed, and I think counties and courts do pursue different procedures around that.
Right. That's, for example, transfer cases. I mean, is it closed when you transfer it, or is it closed when somebody else opens it, or should be closed?
So the reason that when you said that counties may not be correctly tagging them between court supervised and non-court supervised, are those weighted differently in the model?
We use court supervised as well.
Okay, so what you're saying is that when you strip out the non-court, that's where it might be a problem.
Yes.
So I think that's a good idea to bring those people in and find out what they're doing. Standards or how they audit or whatever.
Just Warnock brings up a good point. Are the transfer cases, who is assessed that? If I get a case from LA, does San Diego get that assessment for that case and LA, or is it purely LA, or what? In terms of the workload model.
The workload model relies on the first court closing the case after they transfer, but I don't know if that's done in a really timely way across the county.
Technically, you both get credit, because if the county's reporting it to get grant funding from the feds, when they report it, they would get credit. When they close it and send it to you, your county would want credit. So I bet, I don't know that for a fact, but I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they're both getting credit in a way, because wouldn't that make sense on kind of how the county would think?
Right. At any point in time, you're going to have a number of cases in the system that are going to be counting twice because they're transferring from county to county.
Yes.
Sherry, does that get reported in CHIP 6-2 then when it goes from one county
it
to
does,
another?
It does. As a new opening, and then you close it in this county. And so, again, with the component of looking at models where it includes both, I think that would improve us. No, we need to look at the models and the group needs to decide, you know, what it looks like.
So on the issue of attorney workload on dependency cases, Don will correct me. I have you looking into how to compare and contrast two different sources, what the impact of AB 12 is on the attorney workload, although for both parents and kids, although I'm not sure how that shouldn't have come under a 1 o'clock discussion about quantifying attorney caseload, but all right. And then the third thing was what impact increased interpreter usage might have on it. Do you have other issues, tasks on that, or is?
I would add, I don't know if it comes in here or later, but county parents who are being represented.
Yeah, and that probably should go under quantifying attorney caseload, don't you think?
Sure.
Is that right? What do you think so?
Sure.
Okay. We've kind of mixed those conversations.
Yes,
and that's...
I apologize if I...
No, all of us have, including me.
I followed the conversation that we were having, that you were having about the 18 to 20 and all that. I did not understand what Leslie was talking about, how sometimes they were. I didn't really get that part when she was talking about parents. Do you remember her making a comment?
Well, it's related to what Judge Seidler was...
Oh, the phantom parents. I got that. Okay.
Right.
When you release. Okay, I got it. Thank you.
Not all. If you're 19, the court can relieve your parents, but needn't. Doesn't have to relieve,
got it.
Right?
Okay. Thank you.
All right, so others, if we have 1, 2, 3 general areas, so if we get 3 or 4 tasks in each one, is that going to be too much? So we have 3. Are there others that we need to look at in evaluating the attorney workload on a dependency case, whether what we're reflecting now is accurate? So
if you go back one slide. Anything else we want to touch?
The data that you get from the draft county, is that relevant to this issue? Is there any data that we could mine from there?
Yes, we can. We can pull. We can, yes, we can go into it and try to see by these categories what we're, the draft courts are seeing right now.
That's a great idea, a comparison of how this is reflected what we're actually seeing from the draft court. Elisa, draft count?
Yeah, but don't average it. I think you need to almost, I mean, because of the three that are below standard, one couple are significantly below, and then those that are above standard, we don't want to push them together. You know, we want to see.
Okay, so maybe a spreadsheet showing those kinds of things. As compared to that.
Right. That's a good idea.
Okay. So that's four. Is that enough for that topic? Is that enough?
I'm happy.
Okay. Is now a good time for lunch or should we wait?
Just going to ask one question. We're not talking about the dollars. We're just talking about workload, right?
Exactly right.
Part of that.
The
computation.
Yes, that's the next subject.
Salary
it's supposed to be after
lunch,
but we'll see how that goes.
We always have to do that on their comments.
Okay, so 15-minute break, get your lunch, and we'll talk with each other through lunch. Is that okay? 15 minutes, we'll start it again about 5 till. Go! Okay.
Can we start at 12?
We'll start at noon.
Jake. We'll turn the phone back. Gary,
yes.
No response.
Yes.
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 Okay, that's...
That's just
nice. That's nice from guys. All right. So where were we? Oh. Judge Bakke will be back in a minute, I assume. Audrey suggests, or I think it's a good suggestion. We'll follow the model from the, or we think it's a good suggestion. We'll follow the model the Judicial Council uses. And even though it wasn't on the agenda, what we'll do is we'll open it up for 5 minutes of public comment as we start the next issue on our agenda. And this is one, we've called it attorney salaries, benefits, and overhead. That factors into the funding part of it, and there were concerns that there might be some adjustments needed in how that's factored in. So, public comments. Are there any?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I'll think of something.
Never pass a chance to speak, right?
That's right. So, I think it relates a little bit to what this was when I was from the law center. We touched on this morning, and again, I'm honestly surprised, I guess, by why the salaries, for example, that are in the report and why we can't meet those dollars. Spend our money the way we're told to spend it. We have the right number of lawyers in the counties that are even at 100% or more. But for example, for CLC, we have very low overhead. We are extremely lean in terms of rent and all those fixed expenses, which are supposed to be figured into this. But it gives the average salary, for example, at something like 19,000, what was it? So the average attorney salary in Region 2 is supposed to be $80,000 a year in a fully funded county. That's more than my supervisor's assessment. But I don't believe I'm misspending or mismanaging. And so it's a disconnect that we have to look at. And I'm not saying that Sacramento should be the only example. But I think staff needs to look at the disconnect between what the formula says we should be able to compensate people at and what we're actually able to based on our expenses and our staffing, assuming we're staffing in accordance with our contracts, because at least for the draft county, our contracts tell us how many lawyers we're supposed to have. So if we're doing all of those things but are experiencing expenses that make it impossible for us
county council is the right comparison as the lawyer for the department.
And just one more. Jill Nagner in
San Francisco. Just a
second. Yeah, 1 minute. Jill Nagner in San Francisco. I put a lot of time into my written materials, but I wanted to flag the issue of investigators and how those are not peer information. I think the committee needs to look at that. And also to really examine who's in what region and the economic differences between counties within even the same region in terms of why it's there.
All right, thank you very much. And from the committee, your thoughts on it, if you have tasks that we can assign. Oh, before we jump into that also, because some people, more than one person, are going to be leaving a little bit early. Everybody seems to be trying to beat the expected traffic, and so we thought we would try to finish up at 1:45. It's not very much early, but it's early enough to make some flights for people. So unless anybody has objections, we'll try to do that. Now, on the issue of how the attorney salary benefits and overhead should be calculated, Sherry, you're done.
So one of the things that was identified by the Software Budget Advisory Committee is that we're not there may be other methods than regional salaries. I know in Waltham, in that model, there is a BLS factor applied to an average salary, and that BLS is calculated every year by county based on local costs. And so it might be that we would like to ask staff to see whether or not that would be a good component to use, because that way cost of living in the Bay Area would be closer to the Bay Area and cost in, you know, other areas of the state. So that's the work pretty much been done on the Waltham side. We might want to see what that model would look like. The real question would be how we would get an average salary. And I think you did an update of the regions in 2011, right?
Yeah, we did an update of county council salaries in 2011, but that's the one.
Yeah. How hard would it be to update that?
Hard.
So we might want to do that and look at if we want to stay with regions, and then I would also say we could use an average salary from every region collected and then apply to BLS to have two models.
Don, can you help me understand something? If we're using salaries to compute the needs that are higher than the salaries actually paid, then that's a good thing for the council. And I mean, it's not intended to tell the dependency attorneys what they should be paid. It's intended to try to figure out what they should be funded at, right?
Yes.
That's
how we calculate a estimate of the funding needed, yeah. By the, so, yeah.
So we certainly don't want to lower those numbers to reflect what I'm hearing or the actual amounts paid. And we have no reason to deviate from using county council's numbers. That's an appropriate comparison, right? So what changes? Well, but if maybe others see that differently, yeah.
I just want to make sure I heard it. The contract I've seen for our county draft, they do indicate what should be paid.
Based on this?
I don't know if it's based on that, but one of the questions I had to prepare for today is what was the county council, I think I asked Audrey, did the county council information that the average for our region, and because I looked at it locally, and it's a lot, if you took the averages doing mental math, it's a lot higher than what's reflected in Region 3.
They're old.
Yeah. So I think we should update the county council and then also look at a model by taking an average salary and applying BLS, which is specific to San Diego County and specific to, I think we should just look at it.
And then one of the things when we were on a break that I brought up is just the whole issue of overhead in terms of how many people to staff for attorneys. And it's just like a court. On any given day, we know how many judges on average are going to be out for leave for whatever reason. And if it isn't factored into the model, I think it should be, especially when you have a model, or to look at, especially when you have a model where the attorneys are expected to staff multiple courthouses, or even just courtrooms.
you know, you're not going to, you're always going to have somebody out at some point. And I don't know how you capture that, but I think that would be helpful to know. And I'll do my one last pitch of, I think it would be helpful to do a survey at least to see what counties have what court beyond going back to the morning's discussion about the different hearings, but see what specialty courts, if you will, they have and who staffs it. Is it attorney staffed or not? Just to get an idea of how much how much time is expected of some of the folks of the attorney firm that isn't factored into that spending model. That was my suggestion.
Judge, this is Jake. Just one clarification, if I could.
Go ahead, Jake.
So just in relation to that last comment, excuse me, I mean, that the number of hours that they use for the attorney does factor in standard, you know, vacation, sick leave, holidays. So when looking at kind of developing that complement of staff, it is saying there's only those 1,400 hours per year that's available. So they're taking out the normal sick leave and vacation. Like all of us, that doesn't necessarily address somebody goes out on a long-term disability leave or an FMLA leave that are always challenging, but it does try to at least address standard, typical, on average, attendance-related scheduling issues.
Others? David? So I support, this is David Yamasaki, I support the approach that Sherry had raised. Two other questions that I have relate to how are the supervising attorneys, because this pool requires some oversight, and I would just know, and is the methodology that's used to calculate that variable over and above what Jake is even talking about, something that we should take a look at as well. And the other thing, it relates to the investigators. As I understand it, many of the counties are moving in the area of social workers, and that may require a higher level of skill that may cost more. Is that something that we can also take a look at as well?
I think so. I mean, a way to take a look at it would be asking attorney firms who they are using for investigators and then trying to tag a salary to that. Some use more like private investigators, some use social workers. And so, yeah, I mean, we could certainly do that.
Sherry, going back to your point about looking at the LS, which is what we're using for the walk-up, I think we had planned on updating that index with a routine schedule.
Right.
And maybe we can also pull that in, if that's the method or the calculus that's used for the session.
Perfect.
So since the Waltham, Jake, I think you're the expert on this. Maybe you are, Sherry, but on the BLS issue, then Waltham, for the Budget Advisory Committee, is already doing all the work to collect that BLS factor. So I guess maybe what we could ask you to look in, maybe give us a model how that would compare using the regions that we use now versus using the BLS factor, which is updated every year for Waltham anyway. So.
But update the region first. Because you said it's easy to do, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and
we update and then compare.
Right.
Got it. Yeah, you're right.
And we could also show all the county council average. Like,
okay.
And, so we can look at the BLS index and pull that in. We can update the regions. We can update the county council salary. And we can go out asking what sort of professional qualifications are people using for investigator, and then what that cost, and get average salaries for that.
So I have a question on that. So when you said you would ask the attorney firms, do you keep a mailing list of all of them, not just draft, but also non-draft?
We have a good list for draft and a shifting list for everyone else, yeah, because there's a lot of panels. But we try to keep the panel administrator.
Okay.
And we may also, I'm sure we'll be asking the court executives for help in counties where we don't.
Okay.
Think
indicators tiered by region?
I don't know why that decision was made.
And the second question, in terms of the salaries, that I see that this takes into consideration 25% benefits ultimately.
Yes.
But in terms of the salaries that we're getting from county council, because we still have children and parents, attorneys leaving from county council when they can. So whether it's the Megaplex in L.A. or the pensions in L.A. or whatever, the salary numbers we're using for the county council, is that really taking into consideration all of what would be considered salary or the ones that have extra added benefits?
Yeah. We can certainly, we can look at the salary for county council. We can look at the benefits we get. I would have to find help on how, I would have to find help on how to cost out those benefits, but I'm sure that Kadeem Chang can help us with that. So, yeah, we can look, so not just update the salaries, but really take a look at the benefits they're getting.
Because the 25% benefits we're giving might normally be reasonable, but when you have a lot of county council, we're getting more than realistic benefits when it comes to pension and or extra money, I think it's worth looking at.
Right. Okay.
What would you use for the salary comparison for investigators, which may be social workers instead? What would we look into using for that? Any idea? Were you going to say something? Did I cut you off? I'm sorry. Well, we have county council we can use, and that's a reasonable comparison, but I'm having trouble thinking of what we would use to find a number to fix to the support person.
Maybe. And that's the thing, because there really are different purposes where,
right.
Some of them are basically hired as paralegals that are doing investigation, so you can't necessarily compare the county council or public defender to paralegals. So that's a really good question.
So I guess, this is David, one way to do that is to draw the comparison if the investigator compensation rate is X, and in those regions where you solicit that information, it comes in at X plus Y, then you can maybe get an assessment of the percentage differential because you're comparing two different universes of classification. So that may be a good starting point.
What if you use somebody like the CPS employee? No?
I wouldn't want to pay anything to pay others.
What?
I wouldn't want to pay anyone what they're paid, the little amount of pay they're getting for the work they're doing.
They're that poorly paid. Okay, fair enough. I'm just trying to think of some position to use.
We can also ask the attorney firm
what they're
paying their
sure.
No, there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I do have
one. Oh. Here and then, okay.
When Leslie was speaking, she talked about a disconnect, and I'm not really sure where that disconnect is, but I think it would be something that we would want to look at. And what I heard her say was she has a contract, and her contract tells her as the CEO of her firm or executive director how many attorneys she should have. And I believe that she has draft contracts. So, and then when she actually sits down to do it, the caseload for those attorneys is higher than the 188. So, do you know why that happened?
Well, I think, I wouldn't be surprised if the caseload was higher than 188 because I think caseloads tend to run higher than what we're estimating. But I think the bigger question is what both Leslie and Candy said. Our contracts say we should be able to do this with these numbers, and yet just putting it together in that way, it doesn't work. So that definitely disturbs me in wearing my other hat. managing the draft program. So we will go back and work out what the budgets are in reality for the bigger draft firms now and see what is going wrong. I mean, I think that...
Well, doesn't that also reflect on the numbers that we're using for our purposes?
Yes. Yes, but I think that until, and I mean, I think we can find that out for the subcommittee pretty soon, until we know where the problem is it that the investigator salaries are higher, is it just that the workload is running much higher, is it that the attorney numbers are underestimated? I don't know where that is, but we can find that out.
Okay. I was going to bring up the... Not just the salaries, but shouldn't we be running for county council the benefits as well when I'm looking at what our county pays? Because it's well over the 25%, I think. And then I'm looking on the social workers. Wouldn't that, I know you brought up
about whether we should use that as a comparison, but isn't that really the comparison, the most comparable comparison we have, and then see what my county just
Yeah, I'm looking at what our, for entry-level social workers, I'm looking at what the averages are and what the benefits packages are. It just seems to me that would be a good comparison
okay.
as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Although one difference is that the agency social workers are providing services, investigating and providing services, whereas ours are doing more just investigating and not just service component. Or they're supposed to be providing services.
Okay, sure.
I was just going to say perhaps we should ask Don if we really want to dig into the contract issue and why it may not be working. We want to understand that. I think it's easy to take two courts that are drafted. One that is under standard, which would be Sacramento, and then one that is over standard, and you can take your pick, and look at those two side by side in a spreadsheet and try to figure out what's going on. You couldn't take LA as an under standard because we're too big. It would be too many cases to look at. But I would suggest take Sacramento and take whichever one's over standard as a draft court and create a spreadsheet and figure out where the variances are. I think we could, don't you think that would be worth the work if we're trying to understand it? We don't have access to the contracts in all the other counties, and so the only ones you have access to are the drafts because
right.
you manage them.
Yeah, we could pull that.
Okay.
I haven't been writing them down, but you have four or five tasks on this area already, don't you?
Yes, you do.
Okay. So we probably ought to move on unless there's something...
You're comparing the information you have on drafts and non-drafts, under and over.
Right.
Why not throw one in and get one of the CEOs from the non-draft counties that can give you the information right out of the gate? Because
Perfect.
They're all, except for only a few handful, they're all under.
I just thought the only reason it would be easiest is because the contract.
For
sure. Yeah, he has the contract.
The two of the undrafted counties and tell them the importance. I'm sure their CEOs will work.
Yeah.
But I would take an over and an under again.
Yeah, sure.
We're trying to figure out what to
are
do.
There any over on the non-job
there
report?
There are. Yes. Well, yes.
All right. So,
here's your over and under.
All right. So, the next item for our discussion was we got through our working lunch. So the next one was quantifying your attorney caseload, and we kind of mixed that in with our first area. So so feel free to repeat things or bring up new areas. But you want to make a comment, then we'll ask the attorneys, the public, if they want to be heard.
One question I have in this area, and in all of these areas, is to what extent do we need to be looking separately at counties with less than two dedicated dependency courtrooms and counties with two or more dedicated dependency courtrooms, because in the small, and I know smaller counties is later in the agenda, but I think this is where it's
partially fits in counties that are so small that you don't even have one full courtroom, or you only have one full courtroom, but it's not on the full case load. Can we really be comparing the workloads in the same way to those counties that are able to fully, you know, staff two courtrooms and above? So I just think that at some point for a funding formula and for a workload formula, we need to be separating out those counties that have less than a full caseload, which I think you can quantify by looking at least two, looking at two or more dedicated defense.
And I would argue that that's a funding issue, not a workload issue.
All we're doing is deciding, this is the workload that they have, and this is, we need to decide also, this is a dollar amount to put to it, but then the funding side of it deals with, yeah, but that's not enough for them to have the infrastructure necessary, but that's my opinion, and you're...
Let's
5 minutes. I actually have my timer this time, so I don't need... Oh, she's set. All right, so... Folks?
Quantifying
the attorney case load, yeah.
I think we made our point earlier about how it really comes down to how AB 12 and the rise in online attendance have affected that calculation. In Allegheny County, for example, our non-minor attendance now comprises about 20% of the children. And so how does that affect the multiplier being used to calculate the number of parent clients? And should there be a multiplier to calculate parent clients as opposed to a hard count? And is there some way to calculate the real number for the county of parent clients? So I think there are some ways to tweak that or clean it up, and you know, that is doable within the time of time. And I think those are sort of our my main point in regards to reviewing the way you keep looking at.
Jill McInerney, San Francisco. I would just echo the concern about the parents council and the multiplier. It can go sideways in a lot of different ways because of AB 12, but also as the conversation earlier touched on with different counties appoint at very different rates, and different counties take something off at different rates. And we don't want to put ourselves in a situation of benefiting counties to not appoint council for parents, when we know that best practice is to include everyone early with counsel, because that's going to be the best outcome for kids. So if you use a hard count, we're going to be able to compensate appropriately and actually encourage counties to appoint counsel.
This is Candy May from San Diego, and one of the other pieces to that with the parent count is at the time that this caseload study was done, that formula for the 0.82 or whatever for parents, we didn't have legislation that said you can have multiple presumed parents. And so that has made a significant impact and will continue to have impact on our clients and on our caseload. And so it's important to take those changes into consideration, those statutory changes that have already happened, as well as the strong efforts in many counties towards father engagement. And so those things, I think, really speak to the fact that we need count parents. We know who they are. They come to our courtrooms. We appoint counsel for them. There has to be a way to accurately count them. And we need to know what those numbers really are. And I don't believe that the formula that we're currently using is in any way accurate representation of the parents that we actually represent.
This is Leslie Heimler, Children's Law Center. I agree with everything and would add a couple of things. I don't think self-reporting, even using JCAS data, it's a good way to go because it's very easy to manipulate and not necessarily for bad intention. And an example of that would be in an office that is already under resourced, for example, if the secretary is charged with closing the file in our JCAS system, but she has a stack of files 8 feet high behind her desk and can't get to it because she has so much other work that is under resourced, it appears that that office has more open cases than it really does. And so you would penalize the efficient office that closed files quickly, and incorrectly in a way reward the other. So I just don't think any kind of self-reporting is reliable. I would agree that if there was a way that we could actually count who got a lawyer and how many people are represented, that would be ideal. I don't know if the technology exists in all of the counties to do that. I'm pretty sure it doesn't, and Sherry shakes her head. But that should be the goal, is to actually base it on real appointments. And I there was a comment about at the end of this process sending possible work to other bodies of the judicial council. So I think within all of this, at some point it would be probably worthwhile to look at some court rules regarding appointment of counsel and when counsel are to be relieved within the dependency context, because there are some objective markers in terms of whether the parent is actually involved in the case or not, for example, counsel can be relieved and then reappointed, and that has a very significant impact on both on the numbers, in terms of especially for parents. So
there's 18 seconds. Anybody else want to?
How good.
All right. So you just say amen, right?
Okay. All right. Well, thanks. So is there a way to count the parents that are represented?
Ways that we haven't found a good way, and as we were going through the budget negotiations this year, the Senate asked us to go out and survey to get more up-to-date numbers, and we found that many, many attorney firms representing parents don't have accurate caseload numbers or courts, and that they had great trouble figuring out their caseloads. So we know and then the Department of Social Services does not, they report a lot of things, but they only accurately report the Hegseth mandate report, and parents being represented on one of them, or parents who are part of the case. And then, so we don't know it from there. We do know it from the pool of draft courts, and that we think we have pretty good data because we can see cases that haven't been touched in a long time and are getting old, so we can go back and get people to fix those. But statewide, it's a real problem. There is no accurate count of parents.
I think the only way you're ever going to get this done by April, whether it's five Aprils or this April, assuming the draft information, this is Judge Bakke, by the way, the draft information for most of the 20 courts is fairly up to date and accurate. You have to give basically a statistical sample. There's no way you're going to get accurate information from all 58 courts.
And the problem with that is that the draft...
There's problems with that.
Right. But the one that I would have with it is that the draft courts are by and large over the 100%, which is kind of not an arbitrary number, but are almost all over the percentage, whereas the non-draft courts are almost all under the percentage. So I'm not sure, but go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say the equalizer in draft is that Los Angeles is significantly under standard. And since L.A. is over 30% of the workload, if you look at that, if one of the 20, it's probably closer to, 60% of the 20 or more. So it might be the equalizer, so it might not be bad to at least look at it, and then we can just see.
I have no objection.
And you can account for that statistically by weighting with counties that are under and over. The only real issue here is whether you're going to use what's out there and exists now,
yep,
or if you're going to go to all 58 counties and say, look, we need a 90-day snapshot where everyone's going to have to put down their information, redact names of clients, and someone's going to have to aggregate that, and you're never going to get that done by April.
No, and you can bet that the PJs and the CEOs here are going to object to any additional effort to collect data, right?
Sure. Not from us.
Well,
he's drafted anyway.
Yeah, because yours is in. But no, that's good. So does that formulate
task for you?
We can come back with what we can glean from draft and what we think it says about the state overall. And then everyone can look at that and see if we need to go further.
That's fair enough.
I think that makes sense. I mean, wasn't that one of the purposes of draft in the first place, so that we wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel, which we may have to do anyway?
Okay. Others? I would suggest that our report to the council included both in the introductory paragraph and the conclusion paragraph that we believe this really needs to be a long-term process to reexamine the whole foundation of it.
Yeah, this is like an Elkins-type thing in scope. You know, it's like a five-year-plus type thing. If you really want to look at it, I mean, we don't have time to do that, but it's just, there's all kinds of issues here. But this specific discrete work group, to get this back by April, I mean, there's a lot of heavy lifting that's have to be done. I mean, we're already almost in July, so...
Other tasks on quantifying attorney caseload. A lot of it, like I said, we talked about on the first item on the agenda, but if there are others, now's the time. Do you think you'll be able to do everything we've asked you to do? And
you never asked that question. You just have confidence they will. Right?
I'm not as good an administrator as you are.
Don's words earlier were that he has fun doing this, so that's the case.
We can do some of it, and then we can give you a timeline through the summer for how much the rest of this will take. So, yeah, there's nothing here that we can't do in time for this group to have, you know, a couple of months to really think about the results.
Okay. Are we ready to start talking about the wrap-up part, then?
Could I just insert one other question? This is David. As it relates to the other costs, I know that there's a figure of 33%, right? That's what the documentation says.
What figure are you on, David? Just want to get there.
This would be 16.
Thank you.
And, you know, as we hear how many of the entities are struggling with the fiscal piece of it, can we also maybe survey that to determine what the best calculus would be for that that aspect of it? And that has got to be something that fluctuates from region to region as well.
Definitely, we can. And it sounds like we'll be doing a sort of omnibus survey of draft providers and some others. So we can ask that. That's a place where it will be very different. The firm versus the panel attorneys and then the sole proprietors. So, but yeah, we will go out and figure out what goes into overhead right now.
Small courts. What information would you like? Should we see if we can collect to determine whether there ought to be a factor for small courts? And the issue is, like Judge Zeiler said, the issue is there are some courts that are so small. Yours might be one that would fit in this definition. They're small enough that they have to have a certain amount to have the infrastructure for those courtrooms. My view, like I said, is that goes on the funding side of it, but if everybody else is of a different view, then...
Well, I mean, from my court, we've got dependency 300s 3 day a week. We've got another judge, myself, picks up all the other 600s 2 days a week. Probably should combine them both. Got collaborative courts with 300 drug court part of it.
Thrown in there for a day. Well, that judge is probably overworked when you combine it all for one full court 5 days a week. So, therefore, therefore we need that court to run, but we don't get counted in the bigger courts, two departments or more?
No, I'm saying you basically have a 3/5 courtroom doing defense.
Doing defense.
And I'm saying that we have to take into consideration that you need, even if you don't have, 188 kids, you still need fully staffed, and we need to take that into consideration.
Right. And we have contract attorneys that do an adequate job, maybe need some more of the training that is built into the factors in here, and make them in their contracts do other stuff. So all that has to be, and they're contract attorneys, so we don't worry about the 33% of the overhead and everything else.
And what do you do with collaborating with all these contract attorneys when you as a court want to have efficiency or working out solutions on things?
We just have to either deal with them or tell them that's part of the contract that says, and as it was directed.
When you contract, do you contract for just separate cases a year, or?
No, they're just contracted to be in the court as the court runs. And those that haven't kind of know exactly what they're getting into.
We have the same thing. We have contract attorneys who are also misdemeanor and felony public defenders as well, but you have to realize that there's economies of scale here. There's a minimum amount of funding that a court has to have, depending on size, to get this up and running. But like Tom's court, they have 8. We have 4. And if you look at last year's filings, just as an example, Tom had 190, and we had 130. So it's not, you can't obviously say, well, double the size of the bench and you'll have double the amount of cases. But then if you look at places like Sierra and Alpine that literally have like 5,000 people in the county, Alpine had no dependency cases filed last year, not one. And then you look at the two judge courts, there is a, I think there's a common misconception when people talk about small courts. When you drill down and look at a small court like Tom's versus mine versus like Modoc and Trinity and Del Norte, you are talking about a huge disparity between the number of cases they have with two judges versus the cases Tom and I have. You know, we have the 11th highest caseload non-traffic in the state per judicial officer. We're supposed to have two more judges. We have a dependency judge that is basically doing 300 cases, 2 full days a week with the calendar and hearings, maybe 3. So it's just so hard to say, you know, a small court, because there are differences even amongst the smallest of courts. And there's no real way to allocate any kind of formula that's going to be accurate for funding when you throw in like Sierra and Alpine versus Tehama, Kings, places like that, because there's huge differences even amongst those courts.
And I would say that we do have a minor advocate's office. So when we base our attorney costs, that office, you know, they have a minor advocate. Yeah, that's all they do for the children. And they, in turn, hire out their own investigators, where the private counsel comes to the judges to approve the $40 an hour investigator. So there are distinctions, you know, and it's 7 judge courts. So
7.
And so you're a big court.
We're a big court.
Yeah, they're huge compared to us.
Okay. Well, how does this translate over from the court, impact on the court, to what it does to the attorneys? Like you said, your attorney's contract attorney, so they do this part-time, and the rest of the time they're doing the PI or criminal defense or whatever else they're doing. So how does the concern translate over onto the attorney side of it? And would it be for the workload or the funding? Because I would argue that on the funding side, there ought to be a pool for those small courts that have the 1 year where there's a family with 10 kids, where they usually only have one kid,
And then how do we pay for this one where there's 10 kids without overpaying the next year and the year before? So, but that's on the funding side, not on the workload side.
You know, on the workload side, I don't know how we calculate or weight that in, because a private attorney that's contracted for 300 has the ability to work 2.5 days and work the other 2.5 days privately if he or so she so chooses. So maybe that funding that they're doing is make the piece of them feel like they're pro bono, and the other piece that they're, you know, just covering whatever overhead they
want,
and then
make
the money
on their private stuff. It isn't until, in my experience, at least in far Northern California, state of Jefferson, let's just call it for what it is. that's what they want it to be, some people. Until you get to the level of, like, Butte and Shasta, where you're talking about 10 to 14 attorneys, you don't see dedicated dependency counsel. Anything under 10, Placer, El Dorado, and down, you don't see dedicated dependency counsel. So it's very hard to throw them into a standard formula because, as Tom said, they're doing private work. They have other contracts for public defender contracts on felonies and misdemeanors. It's just, it's very, very difficult.
Right. So go ahead.
The Software Budget Advisory Committee recommends to the council, and they agreed that on our charge, to look at a process where the Judicial Council staff would hold funds, and then they could be provided for unique circumstances. That recommendation actually started to assist the smaller courts when they would have spikes, and along the way it morphed into something else. That's all I'm going to say, right?
That's correct.
So we still need to look at that, and maybe we could build in any concerns that the courts have into that process, so that if you have a hard time finding a specialist that you need for a case, or if you do get a family that requires additional lawyers that are not in your county and they're going to cost more money, or I don't know, whatever those issues are, maybe that should be part of that process where you're already authorized to hold, what, $100,000? Is that what it was? $100,000?
For homicide or for the...
For the dependency council. For the new process that we need to work on that is also due to the council in April.
I can't remember.
Okay, but I think it's $100,000.
We called it an emergency
fund. Yeah, it's an emergency fund. So I wonder if, I'm just throwing this out, would it fit better there, or you think that somehow, I just don't know where it belongs.
See, I think that only applies to the smallest of the small,
okay.
Like the three or four smallest. I mean, Tom's County and my county, we know we're going to have 3 new filings a week. And if you look at the caseload statistics for the last 10 years, it bears that out.
Yeah.
We'll have 3 every week on average across 52 weeks. But if you're talking about MODOC or something like that, where you had the situation where, for example, there was the woman that opened fire on the tribal meeting and several parents were killed and left kids, you know, in CPS custody, that's an aberration. That's what you're talking about there, because there's no dependency council, to my knowledge, that is up there in MODOC County. You have people traveling from Siskiyou and Shasta County to get there. So, yeah, that fund as a reserve.
It'll work for them.
Yeah, that'll work for them. But once you get past that threshold level, even at some of the two-judge courts like Glenn County and Colusa, they're going to have a steady stream throughout the year. There's not going to be too many aberrant spikes. So, you know, I hate to drill down to that level in small counties, but it's on the agenda, and that's kind of how it works in small counties.
So this is Jay. This is Jay Chatters, if I can.
I'm with you. Oh, sorry.
Jake, did you have something?
Yes, yeah, so a couple of points. I think there are, as the judge was saying, there are nuances based on how small are we talking about small. I guess I would disagree a little bit in that I think that the model works fine for Placer County, but that's a parochial issue. I think part of the challenge that we've heard from a lot of the smaller courts, and they've sort of asked me to bring up some of my counterparts, are is it's not just about how the model calculates the workload. Like maybe it is only 3 calendar days a week, and so having 3/5 of an attorney plus conflict and all the, you know, that's for child and parent and conflict is fine, but it's also the issue of being able to recruit and bring in those attorneys, and the concern that you are fighting for attorneys that maybe they're in Shasta County, but you're in Modoc, using that example. And if we do start looking at the BLS as a way to adjust how much funding you're receiving, well, if Modoc is pulling somebody who's from Shasta, that may or may not be possible. Like, it may not give them enough money to do that. So I just want to put that out there. I think because it sounds like Don's going to be pulling average county council salaries, and we can look at that, and we can look at the BLS, we can look by region and not by region. I think that issue can get tied up into the attorney salary component. I don't have a very good answer for how to handle courts where you're falling under needing one attorney, but you're almost close enough to needing a full-time attorney. I don't have any good ideas for that yet, but I do think it's something we have to keep considering and thinking about how to resolve, because you don't want to give Alpine a full attorney when they don't have a filing at all for the whole year. But likewise, you don't want to undercut somebody and say you only get three-quarters of an attorney, and now the attorney doesn't have any time to be talking to people out of court, and all they have is time to be sitting there in the courtroom. And that's not really, fair for their clients or the court.
How about we give Alpine a one full-time attorney, and I'll go take that gig. So do we have anything for Don to look into, or is this just going to be a discussion item for us to continue with in the future?
I'm not certain there's anything to look into other than trying to get those small counties to, have the CEOs give information and see whether or not it makes any difference. So statistical, I think you use the term difference or indifference.
Statistically insignificant. Okay.
So I know even in some of the larger jurisdictions, there are situations that come up that are one-offs. We very rarely see them, but we have to pay for it from time to time. And maybe, soften away a little bit of money that maybe able to address those issues to make them whole. If there's a cost, then it's maybe like a contracted service so that when they come up, rather than funding a full FTE, there would be a mechanism to be able to ensure that that court doesn't have to bear that cost because they were excluded from the formula. They got hit really hard because of an anomaly. But maybe that's the solution. I don't, this is a little different than what we created for the Cluster 1 baseline funding because we don't see these cases in the same numbers or the necessity. So I think, we've been touching upon the idea of having a little bit of money set aside for those situations. And if you guys are already working on that.
Yeah, well, it's one of the things the council approved for us to work on that we haven't started working on yet, but the application process and what it would look like. But it might work here.
Are you thinking, David, just specifically a small county, however that's defined, or were you thinking of a court?
I'm hearing that you don't necessarily have to be a two-judge court to encounter a situation that you were not expecting. It wasn't a problem. So whatever the money is, I think you might have to find making it available for those courts that are going to get hit pretty severely because of the unique case that they're never seen.
Not to repeat, but again, this working group is to have the formula. I present the formula, and then we'll say the workload for, we'll use Alpine because we have it, the workload for Alpine County Dependency Council is 0.3 attorney, which is funded at whatever amount, and then the funding side of it will, I think, is the one. That's where they look at how do we deal with the fact that there are going to be those anomalous cases like that. Which sounds horrible, but I think there's nothing more for us to collect or data for us to look for this, and so we'll include that in future agendas because there are other opinions on that, so I think that takes care of the small counties discussion. Unless there's something, I'm not trying to cut people off. Is there something else? Okay. And I don't, my view on it is at this point, we don't really need to prioritize. You're able to look into each of those issues, and we'll take that from there, I guess.
I was just trying to prioritize.
Okay. And then now the schedule. I think before we met, Don said that he could have us at least some preliminary guidance on each of these questions within about a month. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
So how about if we schedule a telephone call, a conference call in a month? Maybe we can do that by, what's it called? To check with everybody's schedules.
No, go ahead and schedule.
Yeah, just the schedule it so we can set up that meeting in about a month, get information on that, and take it from there. But what do you think?
I think that sounds good to me.
Others? All right.
Do you anticipate, say, a half day or a full day, or what do you think?
I think this one's going to be maybe a couple hours, but maybe you'd see a difference.
No, I mean, we, with a month, we can circulate materials beforehand before we'll have the time to look at what we've come up with. And then, yes, that'd be done. It wouldn't need half a day.
What do you think, Judge Kayak?
I'd say a half day, maybe. I don't know. I have no concept of what the material is. I'd rather have the time and we don't need it versus trying to then schedule everybody for another.
Okay, that'll make it more difficult, but let's schedule it as a half-day meeting, an afternoon meeting, and then and we'll find that time, and then if we're done in an hour or two, then we're done in an hour or two. Okay with everybody? Except Sherry.
No, it sounds fine.
All right, anything else that we need to do?
You said it won't come. Other
issues? Anything else?
Judge, this is Jake. I have one last item.
Good. Go ahead.
So on page 20, and I may have missed it, but there is the note about dependency council funding as a court versus a county obligation. And there was going to be some legislative history. I'm not sure if I just missed it in the materials. But that question has come up in some other discussions, and so I did say that I would at least raise it here as, is that something we're really going to be discussing or looking at? Certainly the legislative history would be helpful, I think, as to whether this should remain. Go ahead.
What Jake is talking about is that there was an item, I think it was an assignment from the judicial council for us to talk about the possibility of the funding going back to the counties from which it came. That was a my understanding is that it became a court obligation by statutory mandate. Well, first it was something else, but then it became statutory mandate. So I think what I would want to do is to advise the judicial council that if they believe that that's a good idea, then they need to task somebody with the job of proposing some legislation that might take it back to the county. But I don't think that that's something that we ought to address between now and when we're supposed to get a report to the judicial council. That's just my hope.
I would agree. And my understanding is when the trial court act went into place, it actually specifically listed dependency council as a responsibility of the judicial branch, and so it would take legislative action.
I think
right, Diane, is that?
Yes. In fact, I mean, that was explicitly stated in the process.
Right, that's my understanding.
I agree. I think we could all agree it ought to be funded by the county and nothing would happen because.
Well, we might disagree, but we can't. Whether we disagree or
right.
agree doesn't.
That's what I mean, exactly. I'm curious, though, what would the attorneys think on that issue? Would you rather have the counties doing this or the courts?
I think it depends on whether your county historically
what
gave you a lot of money or not. In San Francisco, we were doing a lot better when the county was funding
too.
So.
Okay. And that's right. Others?
Well, I think looking at it from a statewide perspective, and in terms of the interest
court then needs to meet that responsibility to have a statewide standard. And I think the other problem with it going to the contained county, even though that was San Francisco's experience at that point in time, it changes. I mean, it's hard enough to get reliability, to be able to plan for the court needs, for the attorney needs, for the client needs, but our experience is that the whim of the CEO or the will of the CEO in a particular county has an impact as well, and I would not want to have to deal with those sorts of potential frequent, those changes. It's very unpleasant.
Hey,
thank
you very much. Potential of children and parents being treated differently on a county level more than you would have in the court level.
Yep.
Well, but the other thing is that when you're comparing county council salaries to dependency for council for families, for children and parents, at least you're dealing with the same pool of money when you're dealing with the county. And I see this being a big challenge for this group is that the county council is being funded through the county.
And I guess it depends on the cycle, right? There are times when the counties have resources and the state does and vice versa. And the reason why we went to trial court funding was the counties didn't have money in some jurisdictions and really affected the level of service. And now we don't have money and they seemingly do, so it's more appealing. So, but getting back to what you said, there's a greater will to be uniform. As well as from a statewide perspective than we would from county to county. I have one other question.
Yeah.
Are we wrapping up?
Yeah, go right ahead.
So early at the outset, one of the areas that I was expressing some interest in and was reeled back in was that one of our charges is not necessarily to look at performance measures and outcomes and such. It's really to look at the distribution formula with what we have, what we know. Do you have any ideas or can you direct me or others to suggest a focus in that other area that we're not supposed to be,
I didn't mean to reel you back in.
Well, I know. The charge that we have is very focused, and this may be a much broader area that will take a little more energy and time and such.
So would you like to see something other than including in our report or further tasks that more information be gathered regarding what best practices are and how they could be implemented uniformly across the state? Is that what you're looking for?
Along that line, I mean, going back to what was just raised right now, we're trying to solve a statewide problem, and we're trying to be sensitive to how important this issue is, the disparity in the levels of service that we have, and we obviously have responsibilities as a branch to serve and hopefully produce some positive outcomes for kids and families, and unfortunately, the product is tied to funding, and we know that there isn't sufficient funding to do what we really want to and what we should be doing, quite honestly. If there's no way we can get there without sufficient funding, where does that responsibility then rest? Judicial counsel, family juvenile, budget advisory committee? I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, not budget, for sure.
Don said that he has data showing the improved outcomes for improved funding. Did say that, right?
Yes, and we've reported it before, and and I was planning to pull that in.
Include that.
Package. Yeah,
is that
but it's just a starting place.
Yeah, is that a reasonable starting place?
As long as we're starting, I mean, it gets me enthusiastic. I'm just hoping that we can maybe make progress, positive progress in this area, over and above, equitably distributing the money and hitting some targets that we would love to do.
I think it's up to the Judicial Council to task some advisory committee. I think everybody's looking at my advisory committee as probably where it would go. With what you're talking about, and I think that part of it is already the task of the Family and Juvenile Law Advisory Committee by reason of when the Blue Ribbon Commission recommended the recommendations that were not implemented, unable to be implemented, when they dissolved their unfinished agenda that the council had approved and adopted in terms of their recommendations became the responsibility of the Family Juvenile Law Advisory Committee. So if some of that dovetails into some of the recommendations of the Blue Ribbon Commission, which I'm pretty sure would probably be the case, then it might raise those items in terms of priority for that advisory committee. And would hopefully, when we mine the data, especially from the draft, I think it's just fascinating that that most of the draft counties are now looking like they have operated in a very efficient manner, or have accomplished good goals for children and families, and I'm very interested in that data and how that worked and how that would promote something, a project or an emphasis for the Judicial Council policy decisions in the future.
One problem is if you measure outcomes, if you look at outcomes, you're never going to know whether it's related to council, courtroom caseloads, the agency improving itself, but there are definitely some numbers to look at, which is number of days from detention to dispo, number of days to permanence, percentage of kids closing home of parent. Right? There are definitely things to look at for the standards, but you're never going to be able to know exactly what the improvement or change was or what caused the downfall. And there are so many different factors dependent.
All right.
I just wanted to add, I mean, I agree with that, but there's also, in addition to what you're saying, there's statutory obligations and whether those are met and measured as well. Like, it comes to court. And, I mean, there are other things that are objective that can be counted and measured without looking at the outcomes that are impacted by so many pieces. But there's also some, if you get to the level of university research, there's a common study that found that kids with lawyers and without lawyers, they get to permanence faster with a lawyer. And they were able to compare a lawyer or not a lawyer in the same court system because they previously didn't have representation. So we would have trouble doing that real time, but there's some academic studies that
okay, I think we know where we're going. You know, we've used the April time frame, but just so that we're all on the same page, in order to get to the Judicial Council in April, we're going to have something to our respective committees by January or February at the very latest. And in order to get to that point and not to have it come back from those respective committees, she chairs hers, so she's got more control than I do it on mine. But in order to do that, we're going to make sure that between now and that January or February timeframe, we're going to keep those, the Budget Advisory Committee and the FAMJU Committee advised of the progress we're making so that we're not seeing it bounce back from those committees. So instead of April, think January, when we need to have our product done. What's that? Okay. And if there's nothing else, I think you can hit the traffic.
That's what we need. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything better than a short meeting? No meeting at all, right?
Thank you.